It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
I'd like to lead you all in a little prayer. Dear Lord, may our feet be swift, may our bats be mighty, and may our balls be plentiful. And Lord, I'd just like to thank you for that waitress in South Bend. You know who she is. She kept calling your name.
This summer, Tom Hanks is managing the impossible, the Rockford Peaches.
Go Peaches!
Says girls can't play baseball. Who says women can't throw?
Slide! Slide! Thank you!
Sounded good.
So let's all root for the girls' team. Let's give the poor coach a break.
You're still missing the cutoff man. Now that's something that I would like you to work on before next season.
Cause it's flash, flash. We're having a bash at the old ball game.
Columbia Pictures would like to take you out to the ball game for an all-star comedy.
They'll pay you $75 a week.
We only make $30 at the dairy.
Well then, this would be more, wouldn't it?
The manager, Tom Hanks.
Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
The catcher, Gina Davis.
What do you say we slip in the back seat? You make a man out of me.
What if I smack you around for a while?
Can't we do both?
The pitcher, Lori Petty.
I made it! I'm a peach! A Rockford peach!
The scout, John Lovitz.
Are you coming? See how it works is, the train moves, not the station.
And batting cleanup, Madonna.
What if my uniform bursts open and oops, my bosoms come flying out?
You think there were men in this country who ain't seen your bosoms?
A league of their own.
All right, God knows we have a game. It's not like any of this helps, believe me.
Directed by Penny Marshall.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? And all I have to say to you is play ball, because I'm Paul Spitero, and I am a huge baseball fan, and I have gathered together some of my huge baseball fan friends here to record with me today. Of course, Sean Whalen is with us as always, Cleveland Indian fan that he is.
It is truly a pleasure to be here, and that's true.
And we have Jeff Vaughn, Pittsburgh Pirate fan.
And Texas Rangers, oddly enough.
Well, two places you've lived.
Good chunks of my life.
Outside of the New York area, because you can't root for those teams as you sit here with your Brooklyn Dodger hat on.
Well, I had to pick a New York team I could root for. So what if they don't exist?
I certainly am not rooting for them in Los Angeles. I'll tell you that much.
No, that's absolutely true.
You're not rooting for them in Los Angeles.
Talk to a Brewers fan.
Yeah, we have John and Maggie Schaefer-Hames with us, and Maggie is wearing her Magnum PI Detroit Tiger fan hat, but they are Brewers fans. And we can relate that in the last two seasons, the LA Dodgers eliminated both of our teams from the playoffs.
Yeah. All right. We happen to have had the best record in baseball in the regular season, something that has never happened for the Brewers. It was a weird season all around, only for the postseason to kind of unfold the same way. So I have not been yet able to put on my cap, but baseball season will arrive, and I will. Anyway, hi, Paul.
Hey, guys. It's good to have you all here again. And, you know, every year, we get John and Maggie on, and we say, you know what? Once a year for baseball isn't enough. We're going to have you on more. And I think we did do one other episode. In fact, I think Maggie was not feeling well, and John came on for one episode with us during the year in between. Yes, for Blazing Saddles. That's what it was. But we do already have plans for another movie that we're going to cover in the not too distant future. So I'm always happy to have my friends here with us so that we could talk about movies in general. But today we're doing the baseball movie that we chose was A League of Their Own. Now, I saw A League of Their Own in the theater when it was out, and I enjoyed it. I have caught bits and pieces of it since then, but I never sat and watched it from beginning to end until two nights ago when I did it for tonight. And I have to say, while I remembered enjoying it, I think my opinion of it is even higher having watched it now. I was surprised at just how much I enjoyed this and how really good I thought it was. And, you know, I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not going to totally ruin my rating just yet. But Sean, how about you?
So when it came out, I saw it in the theater. And at the time, we also had near us a Cinemark, Lowman's Plaza. It was a multiplex dollar theater. So I saw it another two times at least at the multiplex, just because I enjoyed the movie. Hadn't seen it in years. My wife swears that we watched it like a year ago. I know we didn't, because for the viewing of this, it was so fresh. I'm like, I don't remember that. I don't remember that. So this was a joy because it had been so long that so much of it felt fresh to me. So this will be fun to talk about this one and how I feel about it now, because it was like watching a new movie.
What do you say, Jeff?
You know, I think one of the things that I think was great about it was that watching it for this purpose was not very different than seeing extended clips of it in segments, as I have many times over the years. And in this case, I really got to think about the structure of this thing. And it was so fascinating that it's so much setup, and then the action is really condensed into a little better than a third of the film, and then there's the resolution. And it was really fascinating about the structure, because I always thought the movie worked. But it did some things that the screenwriting courses would tell you not to do. And so I was real fascinated with that work. And of course, Lowell Gans and Babalu Mandel, who did it, they're freaking aces. So they can ignore the rules. They know what rules to ignore. And I just ended up being really impressed with it. The things that stood out, you know, there's obviously the great lines and things like that, but the rest of the film is very even. It's not an up and down thing.
And you know, I don't want to treat John and Maggie like as if they're one entity, because I do think they are entitled to have different opinions on occasion. So John, how about you go next?
I'm actually close to Paul with how this went with me. I don't remember if I saw this in the theater or saw it, like rented it some weekend, or saw it on cable. This was the early 90s. So we kind of watched everything. I always tended to watch baseball movies. I remember seeing it back in the day, remembered liking it way more than I thought I was going to like it. Since then, I've seen all the clips and everything. But this time again, wound up enjoying it Much more than I remembered the first time. And as especially as I was going on, the movie was like falling into place in a lot of ways. And I was enjoying it. It's both as a movie and as a baseball movie, it has a lot of good things going for it. It's going to be kind of fun.
John, you just raised a really good point. You said a movie and a baseball movie. I think we all do that with our favorite categories of like, oh, it's really good right. for a superhero film or all this. And that's a really good point. I think maybe we could all address that a little bit later about because you raised a really great point.
Well, Maggie and I were talking about that earlier before we got started. It's like maybe we should like have a subcategory of is it the natural?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you'd have to come up with four baseball movies, you know, right, yeah. of the course. But in terms of movie and baseball movie, we've done that with almost all of them.
I'm going to give you the breakdown on that or the example that I give when you talk about a genre. And the example I use is Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. I always say Batman mm-hmm. Begins is a better superhero movie and The Dark Knight is a better movie. Mm-hmm. But
yes,
I think that's wow. kind of an analogy to what we're talking about here.
Right.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
That's fine. What about Maggie? When did you?
I have no idea. I'm pretty sure the first time I watched the whole movie was with you.
Yeah, we watched it.
And that was years ago.
We at some point during our baseball movie watching thing, we watched it.
I watched it, yeah. So this time through, you know, whenever I watch something or read a comic or, you know, whatever it is I'm doing for a podcast, it's a much more active watching or a much more mm-hmm. active reading because I'm looking for specific things to bring up in the podcast. And this movie gave me no shortage of those.
No, you were more engaged watching this movie than I've seen you in a long time.
I had a really good time watching this movie. I really liked it. Bits of it, you know, made me feel really sad. Bits of it made me angry. And for the most part, I laughed a lot. I really enjoyed watching the movie. I'm glad I got to watch it.
Well, first of all, my first thought is they succeed tremendously because this was over 2 hours long and I was able to watch a movie that was over 2 hours long featuring in fairly big roles Madonna and Rosie O'Donnell without them making me want to just turn off my TV set.
100%. So
that's saying a lot for it. But on a more serious level, I've heard talk where they were saying, well, you know what, Penny Marshall directed this and this is a movie that needed to be directed by a woman to give that perspective. Now, first of all, as Jeff already brought up, it was written by Lowell Gans and Babalu Mandel, who are both men. Mm-hmm. And I think what the movie does is it gives a very fair perspective, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned watching it this time, especially knowing the way people get as far as messages and things like that nowadays, that it might be too heavy-handed and that I just didn't realize it back in 1992. But now I'm looking for it, and I'm going to see how heavy-handed they are. And honestly, my opinion was they really weren't. The points where they get a little bit messagey, I think it was earned. And I think that's more in the attitude towards, well, we're going to close it down because men's baseball is coming back, which I think that's historically true. And the other part of it is where they make fun of it in the newsreels. Hey, you know, she's good at making coffee too, with that kind of thing.
Paul, I think you're dead on right. I was talking with my editor, Amanda Sheriff, today, and she's a huge fan of this. And I said, what do you think of the salient point? And you just hit on it, dead on, which is this, that it is a movie that shows the sexism and shows the unfairness of it, but does not make its male characters the villains in that. And that's a subtlety that and she's a pretty big feminist, I think. And she says she doesn't think that they would be subtle enough to make this movie today to make it right. Without
I think you're exactly right.
Which I would agree exactly with that, absolutely.
There is a TV show or a show on Amazon Prime that's being made and is getting some pretty good reviews. I mean, the usual suspects that would call anything woke are calling this woke. The bits of it I'm seeing are, it's a pretty, This one is definitely much more of a message show, whereas this movie, it was for the time exactly, I think, what it needed to be. I think having Penny Marshall there directing it with directing something that was pretty well written in a lot of places by two men was doing the equivalent of what Delvin likes to refer to as having a black guy in the room. You know, it avoids a lot of tokenism and a lot of just ignorance out of not being a minority, in this case, a woman. So Penny was able to change a few things. But for 1992, I think it was very good. It was both there to explain to people that this was a thing, because the overwhelming majority of people, including probably everybody here that saw it for the first time, didn't know that this was a real league, even though this is a fictional story that took place within it. And so she did a really good job of both showing the history of that, and in just as important as it needed to be for the story, pointed out the very real bits of chauvinism and sexism that they had to deal with at all points of their lives.
Well, if I can jump in and make a point, the first thing that you see in the movie are two boys playing basketball while two girls sit beyond and watch them play. Excuse me. And that kind of sets the theme a little bit for this movie. There is this message of the women that were left behind during the war. There's the message of women not having the same opportunities as men, especially in the 1940s. You know, there's the message of trying to teach badly behaving men manners. The movie does a lot of things. And I think you're right. I think it does it all without being heavy-handed and telling a very charming story, without making the men, I mean, like, Tom Hanks' character is kind of a lovable slob, more than a villain. You know, he slaps the charm school lady chaperone gal on the butt, and I was like, oh, gross.
Different time.
You know, yeah, but it doesn't make it better. It doesn't make it right. You know, but that doesn't also make him the villain. It's just right. That was accepted behavior at the time, and that's what the story part of the story they're telling.
And that's another example too of an actor being as plain likable as Tom Hanks is.
Yeah.
Like, bringing so much Tom Hanks to the role, so you're going to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's going to come out.
John, I think that's right, and I think what's amazing about it is, in the early part of the film, maybe say the first 25 minutes, he's going as little Tom Hanks as possible in terms of the likability, and then just sort of starts easing it in as the script sort of dictated. But I think he walks right up to the line of being unlikable, and then starts doing the Tom Hanks thing.
They didn't write it for Tom Hanks either, which is fascinating. They wrote it for an older man. They were thinking like a Paul Newman or something like that originally.
Right.
And Tom Hanks came when they found out, because the writers had worked with Tom Hanks on Splash.
Splash.
Right. And Penny Marshall had worked with him on Big.
Right. So when Tom Hanks looked at the script and was interested, they immediately brought him in and changed it. But it's funny, the challenge he wanted from that was that it was something that was different for him.
Yeah. Right.
Well, was this after?
I think he really brought it.
Oh, before.
This was before.
This was before Tom Hanks was the Tom Hanks that we know of now. This is him coming off of what you call it. I'm trying to remember the Wall Street movie that he did with Bruce Willis.
Oh, right.
Bonfire of the Vanities.
I'm trying to remember Joe versus the Volcano. He was coming off a couple of like bad movies.
Mm-hmm. Joe versus the Volcano is the first movie that is lit by fluorescent lighting.
Ooh.
Wow.
Interesting fact.
Or so, but it's just awful. I can't.
Yeah. That was a bad decision.
There were many bad decisions, but I think that kind of sums up.
I will say I worked with an editor. He's pretty big guy in comics these days, who at the San Diego Comic Con got into a taxi and said, "Take me to the volcano," which was the only line worth repeating from that movie.
Penny Marshall actually watched like a 25-minute documentary and brought this to the writers, which was the interesting genesis of this whole thing. And she wasn't going to be the director, which I found fascinating. And I watched one of the documentaries that went along with it. Mm-hmm. And because she was making Awakenings at the time that the script got done and they wanted to move forward, and then it became a non-starter, which inserted her back into it.
I think she showed a pretty deft hand as a director in general, yeah, between this big, Awakenings, Jumping Jack Flash. I think she had a pretty good skill set as a director. I think actually this may be not the popular opinion, but I think she was a better director than her brother, who probably had more hits and probably set the groundwork for her to be doing this movie, because you can feel the Laverne and Shirley in here with Squiggy behind the microphone, and the big ragu is in the dance scene with Madonna.
I didn't realize that. I'm really glad you said that. I think that when you see actors who have successfully made the transition to directing, there's something that works that is really an exciting thing for moviegoers.
It's interesting, like when you compare, and you know, they were divorced, but I get the feeling they always had a good relationship. You compare her directing style, in my opinion, is very, very similar to Rob Reiner's directing
naturalistic, or at least the illusion of naturalistic.
They were on very good terms at this time too, because it's Rob's daughter that.
It's her daughter. It's her daughter who Rob adopted.
Oh right,
Tracy Reiner, and she plays Betty Spaghetti, who. You know what? You could see it's not just nepotism, because I got to tell you, the scene when she gets the letter that her husband
had to leave the room,
that really, I was welling up.
I had to leave the room. I was going to cry.
Well, because that's why I said that part of the movie is telling the story about the women who got left behind. Mm-hmm. Not in any way to diminish the experiences that military people have, mm-hmm. but it is also difficult to be the one who's not there when your loved one dies, you know, a million miles away, in a ditch or a field somewhere. I mean, and then not only that, but especially because this is the 1940s, if your husband dies, your life is over. You know, women were so dependent on their husbands. The fact that the women got to have an opportunity to make, what, in the movie they said $75 a week? Yeah. That's pretty darn good money.
Yeah,
it is true.
It's we make only like 35, so that would be more than double, wouldn't it?
Can I say something real quick? It was just before we lose the overall thing on this. When you're talking about Penny Marshall's direction, and also to tag it into John Lovitz, it's originally she filmed like a 4-hour movie. It was much more originally conceived with the script as being a drama. A lot of the dramatic elements were put up. They pushed much more of will they, won't they, with Penny Marshall, with Gina Davis and Tom Hanks, even as far as having a kiss at one point with. And besides that, and there was a lot more about around the beer joint they went to, as well as John Lovitz had a lot more film. He was meant to be a much more unlikable character, but the audiences, they realized, were just laughing at every single funny line he did. So they cut everything but his best lines, and it creates this absolutely memorable performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
And an actual cow born right there when he like yells at the noise. That was a real cow that had just been born.
The writers actually wrote that part specifically for him, which was odd for them. They had not written a part specifically for an actor before, which I was shocked by that in the documentary too.
I didn't know that either. That's phenomenal.
Now, what I heard, we talked about Penny Marshall's naturalistic style towards directing. What I heard that she would do routinely is when the lines of a scene were done, she would just let the camera keep rolling and let the scene keep going and allow the actors to improvise for a couple of minutes or a couple of seconds or whatever it might be. She wouldn't just get to the end of the scene and yell out cut. She would wait and let things roll and see what developed and see if there was something worth using there. And, you know, I mean, I guess that's something that eventually became a big style in things like Spinal Tap and movies of that nature, where they are largely unscripted and they're more just, you know, setting up a scene and letting the people improvise. But I think there's an element of that to this movie. And I bet you that there's a lot of lines in here that were not written by the writers and that were created by the actors.
One of the things about it is we're talking about the difference between a Spinal Tap, where you have a story skeleton and they were largely improvising, or this, where you've got a script and then you flow from it. And overall, I think this kind of thing produces better results. I mean, you can't argue with Spinal Tap, or at least I don't think you can. But I think that this there's some real power in this, whatever is improvised or what wasn't. And I think really you only have to look at Splash to realize these guys can write comedy, but also comedy with some depth to it and some real emotional pulls.
Well, these guys, I mean, they started, I believe they started as a writing team on The Odd Couple back in the early 70s. Yeah. And then they were together through Happy Days and Mork and Mindy and, you know, all the Gary Marshall shows, basically.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, much like the way you described this one where Penny Marshall came and said, write this script, that it was the same type of development when they wrote Night Shift, which is one of my favorite movies.
Sure. Forgot about that one. I'm going to have to go watch it again.
To piggyback off of something that John and Paul were saying before, if you have seen this film and you haven't watched in the extras, the cut scenes, especially the ones narrated by Penny Marshall, do yourself a favor and do that. Because what Paul was alluding to before about her letting the camera keep rolling, there are specific sequences with Tom Hanks, especially when the girl's throwing up, you know, and they kind of played the game with her to get out there. That scene is much more extended and is an example of letting the camera roll. And you can actually see a great example of it there, that there's so many scenes that were cut from this, and she cut it due to time. I'm like, I don't know, 2 hours and 7 minutes, I was still raring to go. You could have thrown these in there and I would have kept going.
But you realize for a comedy, it's already a half hour longer than they like to go.
Right.
So that's pretty amazing. And when you see those choices, and to me, this is where a director and editor come into the thing, where you've got scenes that you think are of equal value or at least really good. I know I was helping a friend turn a screenplay into a graphic novel, and his dialogue was like the most painful thing to ever cut because it was so tight, and it gave me even more of an appreciation for people who can cut good stuff, because I know I had that struggle with just on that level. So when you see something and it's filmed and it's polished and you're ready to go and it doesn't make it, and in some cases you're leaving some new person's best footage on the floor, or some star that you've paid a lot of money, you've cut down to this much time. There's artistry to that. That's not, that often goes underappreciated.
Now, the most amazing thing in this movie to me, the thing that I just still to this day can't get over, is in the Hall of Fame scenes, that is not Gina Davis in heavy makeup. That is a different actress who looks exactly like Gina Davis in heavy makeup. And it's like when I saw that wasn't her, I was amazed. I had no problem accepting that the actress playing Lori Petty as an older woman was not the same person.
Yeah.
But I was sure that was Gina Davis.
Yep. It helped that they overdubbed Gina Davis's voice over hers. But yeah, I knew that at some point, but the first time I saw it, I didn't know that.
Now, Maggie mentioned earlier about how in the beginning scene, there's the two boys playing basketball. And that scene actually kind of just sets the stage for what we're going to see in the flashback when she goes to the two boys and she tells the older boy, you know, be fair, let your brother have the ball, let him take his shots. Then she goes to the little brother and says, kill him.
Yeah.
So, you know, it shows she learned her lesson about sibling rivalry and how to deal with it, you know, and how that worked out. So that sets forth for me the major debate of this movie.
Well, here we go.
Did Dottie drop the ball intentionally at the end? I have my opinion, and you're not going to change it one way or the other, but I'd like to hear your opinions.
I figured you were going to ask this one, so I was thinking about it today.
Did you come to an opinion?
My opinion is that she did not do this purpose on purpose for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't really make too much as a character. It doesn't make that much sense that she would deliberately throw a game and let the entirety of her team down just to make her sister happy as much as she would want to. It doesn't really, it would be a really bizarre swerve for that. But then I could easily talk myself in the other way. It does seem a bit bizarre at the end anyway. It's like, she's gone. Nope, back. We made it all the way to Yellowstone and then turned around here. You know, you're not on the roster. You can't just play.
That was
right?
My point. I'm like, she's not on the lineup card.
All right, I'll sit down. No, you could play.
No.
Well, you're already dressed. So.
No, I don't think that she did. And another clue to that is that she was able to hit one of the high fastballs. So the kid had been learning in the meantime and got better and, in this case, possibly wanted it more.
Anybody else have an opinion on that?
Sean?
This time through, I felt like she did, but I could see myself, based on my mood, feeling very differently. It's funny, one of the co-writers said that he felt that it was not on purpose because of the fact that she was too good of a ball player to throw the game. Penny Marshall left it up to the audience to kind of leave it to do exactly what we're doing. But I'm being honest, as far as this time through, did I feel like she did? Yeah, but I feel like maybe that was my mood watching it this time through. Because I could see, and I see why it's such a debate, and I love that. I actually think that that's a brilliant choice, because I don't have a strong argument for people that are saying she didn't. I like both sides of the argument, and I think is creative.
I'll make mine story based. Mm-hmm. One, John, you mentioned she's not going to do that to the rest of her team.
Mm-hmm.
Two, as much as doing something for her sister, if it's an out, they go to extra innings. The game is not over. Oh, her team had not won. Mm-hmm. And that to me, that's the make it or break it of this, because she's not going to cheat. Right. She's not going to just roll over and cost her team the championship. If it was an individual sport, if this was tennis, I think
yes, I think she would throw a tennis game. I think 100% she would throw a tennis game for the reason. But I'm sticking with, because there was a team, and as it's already been established how important this team was to her, she had as much into making this team as Tom Hanks's character did. I mean, she came up with the lineup in the first place.
And so that's why I come down so squarely on she dropped it. And I got to say, exquisitely filmed, because there's no visual evidence that it was on purpose or not. And as a storyteller, and the fact that we're having this discussion a million years later about it, that's a little bit of genius right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I just think character-wise and story-wise, to me, it's funny, because I was the kid with a baseball rule book when we started playing baseball. no hiding from that. When I was the littlest kid in my grade every other year in elementary school, so I knew the rules. And so that's my bias going into this. And it's just, you look at where she is as a character, you look at what she's gone through, you look at the fact that she came back.
Right.
Paul, let's hear it.
Well, I wanted to let Maggie give her opinion.
Oh, sorry. Maggie, sorry.
Oh, yeah. I don't think she did it on purpose. Partly, at least mostly, because in a previous scene, when Kit is pitching, and she clearly can't pitch anymore, and Gina Davis and Tom Hanks are out there, and he says, "No, what do you think?" And she says, "She's done. She's throwing, what did she say? Right. Grapefruits out there." I don't think she was the kind of sister to let her sister win. I think she would have preferred for her sister to beat her fair and square. They were clearly very competitive, friendly or otherwise. So I can't, and also not letting her team down. Yeah. She is not the kind of person that would have thrown a championship for her sister at the expense of her entire team. That's really not the kind of character they were depicting, I think, in this movie. So I don't think that she did it on purpose.
Yeah, well, I agree with every one of you except for Sean. I felt
that's,
all
that's
along.
That's kind of typical with the two of us.
I felt all along that, first of all, her personality was such that she could, I didn't think she was able to throw a sporting event. Right. I think she, you know, I don't think she, you know, it, she was a complex personality because she didn't need the competition. She was ready to give it up and leave. But once she was part of it, she gave it 100% at all times. She wasn't able to just dial it down. So I don't think she could intentionally even drop
to something,
the ball.
Even to something simple as handing Tom Hanks a Coke, she didn't give up when she committed to something.
Yeah. You
know, when he was going to drink and he hands her Coke and just their repartee back and forth. And he goes, you know, drinking it. And, but just something like wanting him to be the best version of him, to me, that backs us up.
It does add more weight this time to the fact, I'm contradicting myself, but I still feel the same way emotionally. But, her sister being so driven, if you take a look at her motion into the plate, it was so aggressive. And I really loved the filming of that scene because of the fact that you saw her sister giving her all on a just a completely different level. The way she tackled, I mean, we've seen some pretty heavy hits in this film, which is a testament to the actresses, because in order to do that, they didn't have doubles. One of them, that you remember the one who did the slide where she had the
raspberry, the strawberry, or whatever you want to call it.
She had that 1 year later.
That was real, yeah.
Which to me is, it's not something that we're very used to in film. We're used to there being stunt people doing all those pieces. They actually had
to. Can I just point out that that's exactly why you shouldn't let women play baseball in skirts?
Yes.
Well, you know what? You know what? You don't want to.
Bruce was real.
You don't want to do that. We got 100 people out there who'll do it in a bikini.
The bathing suit.
Yeah.
No.
But I think the point is driven home even further by the fact that just before that happens, she goes over to the pitcher and says, "Throw a high hard stuff. She can't lay. She can't hit it, and she can't lay off of it." So right. That's her saying right there to her, basically non-verbally to her sister, "If you want to beat us, you have to show that you're able to. I'm not handing you this. I'm not giving you this. You have to take it." And I think when it happened, and I thought I felt a kind of progression through the scene, that she was upset that she dropped the ball at first and that she didn't come to grips with it until she came out and saw her sister signing the autographs for those kids. And then she realized, I'm glad this happened. Mm-hmm. I think she couldn't do it intentionally.
It gets back to the reason that we're even having this discussion is one sister needed it and the other one didn't. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, well, she got to go home with her boring husband and be married.
And the difference between wanting it and needing it, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's what it is you show me how much you want this. You want it badly enough, you have to overcome your weaknesses. You have to hit that high fastball and you know, then you're going to have to come in and knock me down.
Which is a truism in sports.
Oh, sure.
You know, sometimes it is your desire for this enough that you transcend where you are.
And this is where I'm going to get on my soapbox, that I don't like participation trophies for exactly that reason, because I think it tends to negate the need to excel. You know what? I'm going to get a trophy just for showing up. I don't have to be the best or try and be the best.
There's an amazing thing, and everybody's got some version of something like this in their life. But in my case, our nephew had, when he was a little kid, loved this trophy that was his dad's. Okay? It was his dad's trophy, but he kept it in his bedroom. And he thought it was great. And when he earned his first trophy in Taekwondo, he walked into the bedroom, picked up that trophy, gave it back to his dad, and put his trophy there. And man, you have a lot of people I guess I'm old enough I can say young people. We get a lot of people who don't know how to lose graciously.
That's what I was gonna add to this too, just in terms of what's really neat about this as a baseball movie in terms for me, is that the good guys lose. You know, of course they split it up so we get a little bit of a victory, but the team we've been following plays, and if we establish that it was not thrown, they gave it their all and they lost. Because that's a lesson you have to learn, especially as a baseball fan, driven home by the fact that this was filmed in Wrigley Field. If you're a Cubs fan, get used to this nonsense. Because
yeah, you had 100 years between World Series.
Yes.
But and then there's also the fact that I don't know what Dottie's war was, but they played the first six games of this World Series without her.
Yeah.
So maybe they would have won it in without having to get to that seventh game.
Interesting. Yeah, good point.
I was too busy enjoying that bit because it was so much like Major League, just in terms of how you show a montage in baseball so well by with using newspapers, that technique of just scanning across, mixing that with footage.
That's a great point, John. We're unfortunately, because of the absence of newspapers in so many cities, that's a motif that's going away from us now.
Yeah.
But when we're doing historical stuff, it's still there.
And the newsreel, I thought that was very
effective.
And Harry Shearer. Yeah, I was just going to say.
You know, one of the things we haven't thought is there's a lot of faces in this movie. I guess we touched on it, Carmine the Big Ragubian in there and things like that. But there's a lot of faces that later on have bigger careers.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them surprised me, and I had no memory of a couple of them.
There's definitely a lot of...
Taya Leone has a good part.
Yeah, Taya Leone was the first one. I was like, what? I had no memory of that.
And I think we got to give credit to a somewhat understated performance, because he's not somebody you walk away saying, oh, you know, what a great performance. But it really was David Strahan.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yes.
We were talking about him too. It's the guy from The Expanse too.
Oh, Iroh, the guy who played Iroh.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen him give a poor performance. I think he's routinely in a smaller role. I don't know if I've ever seen a David Strahan movie. I think it's always been where he's a supporting player.
Right.
But it's always very, very solid.
I would say the cast in general. I mean, talk about a movie that really, even though, you know, you'd say Kit and Dottie are your like two big players in all of this, I liked hanging with everybody, which is my favorite sports movies have that. Like, I really enjoyed the entire cast. I felt like they were a team. I felt like they were personalities. There weren't a lot of what I would call traditional background characters. Everyone had their little sub stories that were intriguing to follow, which it's hard for a film to balance that. This is an example of 2 hours and 7 minutes being needed, because I felt like I knew everybody and I was invested. Even when people switched to other teams, you know, I cared about the other team, you know, because we saw them earlier on in tryouts and things like that. It was really cool the way that they managed to do that without anything being forced. It all felt very organic.
I think that's really, really an excellent point. And I think that comes down to Mandel and Gans having the TV background.
Yeah.
Because you had to write faster. Their belief was a joke every 30 seconds at some point. And they trade joke for important moment because some of them are serious.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that can't make that transition. And they, of course, in this, they did brilliantly. And as you mentioned, they wrote all this extra stuff and Penny Marshall filmed even more and all that. So again, Penny Marshall and the editor, whose name I should have written down, and I didn't, coming down to that, really impressive.
Edited by George Bowers.
Okay.
I don't know what his career is.
Paul alluded at this before, but for me, seriously, this is the only movie I can stand Madonna in at all. And I like her in this movie. Like, yes, she's so understated, and she's done, I guess she was just a terror on set and all these things. But she was so well used. Her talents were there. You know, there was enough of these. Right.
The dance scene with her is right. very, very catchy. Like you're watching yeah. that, and it really was riveting. And then the comedy was, you know, when she came out of the confessional. That was her funniest moment.
And the priest was sweating. You know, I similar. I've got two movies for each for Rosie O'Donnell and Madonna, and that's the utmost limit of me standing them. Rosie O'Donnell was in Beautiful Girls, and she played a character that was just very appropriate. And Madonna as Breathless Mahoney and Dick Tracy.
All right.
I agree with you on Madonna, although I think this is a better performance.
Oh, yeah. I just thought she was outstanding in that movie. And really, these are the only two things I even come close to liking her in, and I like her in both of them. So
This part was written, was added for Rosie. She had auditioned for, what's her name?
What's her name?
For Marla.
Yeah.
I can see that. Sure.
But the gal who they picked for Marla was just so great.
Perfect.
But they liked Rosie, so they just wrote Rosie into the bit where she would just hung around and did one-liners.
Well, and that's why I was asking if this was before or after Forrest Gump, because I was trying to figure out who was the bigger star at the time, if it was Madonna or Tom Hanks. And it definitely would have been Madonna.
Madonna would have been the bigger star. This would have been like a prayer time.
But I think that's kind of...
But she wanted to be in this. Mm-hmm. This wasn't something where they had to approach her. She came to them and said she wanted to be in this.
Dang.
And then Deborah Winger said,
"Well, but I think that's nope. how you handle a big star like Madonna, is you put them then in a smaller role. Because otherwise it would have just been the Madonna in a baseball movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wouldn't have been as good. Had Gina Davis done Beetlejuice yet? When this was made, is that how I know Gina Davis?
I think so. Yes. Beetlejuice, I think, was in the late '80s, and this is '92. I never saw Beautiful Girls, so I can't comment on that particular role. But the other role that I can handle Rosie in was a voice acting role where she did one of the apes in Tarzan, the Disney version.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
She was funny in that. But otherwise, I have a very low tolerance for either of those two.
I used to like her stand-up probably back at that time. She was really popular. That was before her show and stuff. And she's very funny in this movie.
She was really funny. I enjoyed her. And I think, but if she had a bigger role, it would have been too much Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah.
If Madonna had been in a Gina Davis role, it would have just taken over.
I suspect that they filmed a lot and they edited it to be just the right amount. I thought this, just keeping to move it along, I thought the soundtrack / score in this was very, very appropriate. I thought it kind of gave you the feeling for the era that it came out, but it also had that liveliness to it that lends itself to a baseball movie. So I really liked the score. Again, it's another one where I can't say I know what it would sound like if I put it on in my car, you know, with no video. But with the video, I thought the score was excellent.
And it did. It was energetic, and at the same time, not intrusive where it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Which is always a key in my mind.
And they played some swing that wasn't in the mood for once. Every World War II movie, it's got to be in the mood. It's like it really wasn't that popular of a song.
Well, and I will point out that that was Hans Zimmer of the Lion King.
Yes. Yes. It's not like it's an unknown.
He did a lot. He's done a lot of movies. Hans Zimmer has, and he has a very. Oh, I'm looking at it right now. Pirates of the Caribbean as well. Mm. He definitely has a style.
Oh yes.
You can tell a Hans Zimmer.
Boom.
Mm-hmm. Any other points on this?
I think that I think that one of the things I guess we've all sort of touched on is. You look at when it was made and everything else like that. And yeah, I get that some modern audiences might have their predispositions, but this movie stands up really well. This is a nicely made film. It's an excellent bit of craft by so many professionals. And think about all the categories we've talked about, and nobody during this whole thing, nobody has said, "Oh, but this part sucked." Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice.
I agree. I agree totally. And that's, I was torn on this one because I really, really, really wanted to give it a Jaws. Because for exactly the reason you just said, there was nothing in this that falls flat. It was entertaining. I saw, you know, it was over 2 hours long. I never felt myself like looking at my watch, you know, how much we have left. I thought it was almost seamless between the old footage and the modern footage. As far as, you know, the book ending of it, I thought it, you know, it served the purpose really, really well. There were points when it had me laughing out loud. There were points where it had me welling up that I was ready to drop a tear or two. I felt that it gave a message about this woman's league without ever being preachy. So you could just enjoy it on the level of, hey, it's a comedy that I'm enjoying, but you could also enjoy it as a historical message movie. And yet I've watched this once in the movies and once now, and I haven't really felt the need to watch it again, even though I feel it is very rewatchable. I think it's a very, very high Jaws 2, scratching the surface of Jaws.
I did also just want to share, if I may, apropos of nothing. Kenosha and Racine are both Wisconsin towns. And my great aunt, who spent a lot of her life living down in Milwaukee, knew a woman named Joan Holderness, who played at the age of 16 for this league, and she played for the Kenosha Comets. Her dad had to sign the contract for her because she wasn't old enough, and her mother would not allow her to travel. So for half the season, she didn't get to participate because she had to stay home. But when they were in town, like in the area, she got to play. She actually played for a couple of teams. She played, I think, from 1949 to 1951.
Yeah, it is important to point. Very it cool. was our neck of the woods where this was.
Yeah, it was in the Midwest. It was Wisconsin, Chicago.
And just to tag on one thing about the real life league this is based on, they did give the impression a lot that the league was less popular than it actually was. Because even after the men came back from World War II, this was still the most professional people were able to see live in a lot of places. In the Midwest and places that they couldn't easily get to a city, because these were not just talented women. These were professional level baseball players. They could have competed on some teams.
If I may, that scene with Marla and her father, that scene almost brings me to tears when he's talking about how he let his daughter down by raising her like a boy. And he's telling the story. He said, you know, hell, like minor leagues or whatever. He said, if she was a boy, I'd be talking to the Yankees and not living in this place. You know, like she was. Yeah,
what a hitter.
There had to have been women that, if things were different, could have had professional baseball careers. But, and this is coming off of the idea for a while. I was telling John this when we were watching it. I'm like, people used to believe women shouldn't even exercise because they thought it was bad for women to exercise. It got them too excited.
It would make them less merry.
It would, yeah, like it kind of ruined your, I don't know, virginity or whatever to exercise.
To finish the one point quick, it was the thing that actually really killed it 100% was television. At baseball games being on television, suddenly you could see it. It was always the radio sport and still remains this, but when people were finally able to see professional baseball players play on TV, that was kind of the last death nail. But they were for 12 years of these, and they had some really good attendance records. You can look it up on Wikipedia.
Well, and now there's an organization called Baseball for All, which promotes baseball organizations specifically for girls in schools, parks and recs departments, and things like that, trying to really promote girls being able to play baseball for everybody.
Cool.
I'm just looking at the cast. I was looking at some of the minor roles in here, and one of the Racine pitchers was played by Janet Jones, who was at the time, I believe, a supermodel, and is probably more famous now for being the wife of Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, that's the one hockey player I know.
one hockey player a lot of people know.
Yeah. That's the other thing you can tell. They didn't have a Wisconsinite in the room because it's Racine.
Yeah,
but every single time that it's anywhere, it's always Racine. No, it's Racine.
We don't know why.
The one thing I wanted to say before I gave an overall rating was the end where they're at the Hall of Fame. with the exception of the stars, the characters that talk to Dottie, all of the background people were veterans of the league.
That's what I thought. Yeah, that they had actually yes. were real women who actually
The one that calls her the best player who ever played was a Hall of Fame player herself.
So it's very cool. Mm-hmm. I a low Jaws, but I give it a Jaws because I think it was the best possible version of this movie that it could have been.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And I'm an enthusiastic Jaws, and it's and really and that's not a knock on anybody. It's this was a really enjoyable Jaws. And that seems like a weird thing to say, but a lot of times when I look at a Jaws movie, I'm looking at thought-provoking. It's something cutting edge and all that. I really enjoyed my time with this. And I can't remember the last time after I was done watching a movie where I wanted to dive into every possible extra I could find. I watched documentaries. I watched every extra scene. I watched anything with Penny Marshall I could grab where she was talking about this film. And then I wanted to go and rewatch the film again. And the only reason why I haven't is because we're here talking. I mean, and that's great. I mean, it's sometimes with, you know, sometimes movies are just fun and they wind up a little lower on the scale and they're fun movies. This was just a really great time with a great cast. And I don't think there was a wasted moment. This is what I want from an enjoyable, rewatchable movie. It's okay that I watched it three times in the past and haven't seen it in multiple years and come back to it right now and just had a great time with it. That's a great movie. This is one that I certainly won't sit on again. My wife swore that we watched it a year ago. We didn't. I would not have forgotten this. This was really, really fun. And sometimes fun is a diminishing term. I disagree in this case. This is a really fun movie that I'm glad I watched. I've kept this on the bottom of my radar. And you and I, Paul, we did this desert island movies. This should have been on my list somewhere.
Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a no-talent pile of pig shit, and that was on the day that my parents drove up from Michigan. But did I cry? No. I give it a Jaws as enthusiastic as he did for the same reason. I was so solidly set to give this a Jaws 2 when I started watching it, and I was kind of floating around there, but it went to Jaws immediately afterwards in terms of I'm going to reincorporate this into the rotation of baseball movies we watch again, because it was fun. It had everything that I want in a baseball movie, especially in a historic baseball movie. It was very well done. We didn't, have to talk much about the costuming and things like that. Those were all great as well. It was just fun. So Jaws for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say I'd give it a Jaws. It's charming. It's fun. It's kind of a feel good movie, even with some of the downbeats. Mm-hmm. It's sweet. I love the story. I love the baseball in it. And I'd like to give a shout out to my favorite line, which is when Tom Hanks and Gina Davis are arguing about the squeeze bunt play, and he tells her to quit thinking with her tits. And I'm just like, I could not stop laughing. I'm going to start using that in my everyday vernacular. I'm going to start telling people quit thinking with your tits. Right.
Just make sure you know where human resources is, because you'll be on your way.
It was really at the grocery store. It was real fun.
So I want to thank you guys for all coming on and doing this with me today. And this was very much fun. I enjoyed this very much. Thank you for the time. I hope our listeners enjoy it just as much. And if they haven't seen this movie, or if they haven't seen it in a long time, it is absolutely worth revisiting.
I think you opened with the right phrase, given the timing of this, play ball.
Yeah, absolutely. And I I'm, as I am every year, I'm excited by the oncoming baseball season, which as we're recording this, we're a couple of weeks from it, and we'll see when you get to listen to it. But and then there's that famous Family Guy video where it's the typical Met fan where they say, oh, it's opening day and the season is over.
That has nothing to do with Mr. Met signing with the Dodgers.
Mr. Met, yeah, the Dodgers can sign everybody, apparently.
Well, you know what? We're all tied right now. Maybe the Brewers will get a... I'm excited to find out who the Brewers are going to be this year. The same place I am every year. For my first 2 weeks, I'm going, who are these people?
Yeah, we have a bit of a major league situation. Some of these people are dead.
Well, I'm going to be curious to see how Brandon Sproat does on your team since we sent him over to you. And I saw him as a potential top talent, so...
Ooh,
he is exactly the kind of guy that the Brewers like to really make shine. So I'm excited about having
him. It'll be a good season.
But yes, thanks for having us on for more baseball.
Yeah, good luck to everyone's favorite baseball teams this season. I hope everybody wins all the games.
Except for the Dodgers.
And that's why we don't have any LA Dodger or Yankee fans on this show, because we want to root every. We want to wish everybody well.
Yeah.
And I'm also looking at you, Atlanta Braves. Okay.
You know, the Cubs can go ahead and
All right. Well, thank you, guys. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Say, Evelyn, can I ask you a question? You got a moment?
Mm-hmm. Which team do you play for?
Well, I'm a Peach.
Well, I was just wondering, because I couldn't figure out why you would throw home when we've got a 2-run lead. You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you. Now you start using your head. That's that love that's 3 feet above your ass. Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball!
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris! Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig shit. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No, no.
No! No! And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball! No crying!
What's the matter, Jimmy?
What? She's crying, sir.
I didn't mean to do that.
Perhaps you chastise her too vehemently. Good rule of thumb. Treat each of these girls as you would treat your mother.
Anyone ever tell you you look like a penis with a little hat on?
You're out of here!
Oh, no,
right
no, no,
now,
no,
Jimmy,
you,
I heard
you
that!
Misunderstood. You misunderstood me!
No, I didn't.
You can't throw me out for
second,
that!
Jimmy.
No, you got a strike!
Right
off the
bat!
No! I can't believe no one ever called you that before!
That's me. I'm in charge now.